Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Know-How is brought to you by Cashfly.
Today on Know-How,
a virgin prepares for Maker Faire. And in this case, the virgin is me, and I'm a virgin of going to Maker Faire.
Welcome to Know-How. It's a Twitch show where we build, bend, break, and upgrade. I am Father Robert Ballasaire.
I am Megan Maroney.
And for the next however many minutes it takes, the two of us are going to open up the knowledge jar on top of your neck and pour in the knowledge, because that's what we do. Yeah.
And it's all about Maker Faire.
I
am a virgin. Do you call Maker Faire virgin? Is that a thing, or did I just make it up?
You know what? Sure. Yes. It's an app term. It works. And you're absolutely right. Next week is Maker Faire San Mateo. Now, for those of you who have never been to one, there are two large events in the United States every year. There's Maker Faire San Mateo, and then there's the World Maker Faire in New York. We've gone to the San Mateo one every year for the last, 10 years, and we've gone to the World Maker Faire three or four times. The idea is to have a festival, not just a conference, not just a show, but a festival of people who like to make things. And it's every kind of discipline. You know, if you like robotics, you'll find something. If you like rocketry, you'll find something. Drones, microcontrollers, knitting. I mean, it really is from A to Z as far as people who have a creative streak in them.
Excellent. Now, does it cost anything? Do I need to be buying a ticket?
Yeah, there's normally a ticket. And, we got the press tickets because
we're press.
Because we roll like that.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, it's very minimal. They just basically want to cover their costs. This is really supposed to be a celebration of the people who like to think a little bit different. And you'll see a lot of that. You know, it's tempting to think of a show like this only in terms of, Intel's going to be there and Samsung's going to be there, because that's all of our other shows. That's all the other events that we cover. But in this particular case, 90% of the people who show up to a Maker Faire to exhibit, they're just, you know, kids, their grandparents, their aunts, their uncles, they're those people who have an interest that maybe they want to share with others. So you'll see like a Lego pavilion. You'll see a pavilion with interesting physics and science experiments. And then, yes, you're going to see some built out electronics, robotics, and super advanced IoT devices. But I wanted to give you a little taste before you jump in, because it can be a little bit daunting. One of the things that we've often described it as is a mix between CES, which we have in January, and Burning Man. And that's not even a joke, because some of the same exhibits that will be there will be at Burning Man every year.
But there's a lot of nakedness, so I hear, at Burning Man. Is there nakedness at Maker Faire?
Naked robots.
Okay.
That's about it. No, it's a family show. It's a family show.
Okay.
And actually, they really do push that. The whole idea is, if you've got kids or if you've got nieces or nephews, no matter what they might be interested in, just bring them. Because guaranteed you're going to find something there that catches their eye, that catches their interest, that makes them, you know, say, maybe I want to do that.
Okay.
So I thought we'd start it off. We're going to go back through some of my favorite Maker Faire segments from previous years with something that's a little bit futuristic. We're in California, and we just passed that law that in 2020 all homes have to have solar panels. So we're into alternative energy.
Okay.
It's a thing. No, not that other law. Okay. I know which one you're talking about. But it's kind of the same. This is a technology that has actually been around for centuries, believe it or not, but is making a comeback. So, hey, Burke, why don't we go ahead and take a look at the gasifier?
Thank you.
I know here at TWiT we have talked a lot about alternative energy, but there is one that we haven't really talked about, and that is the use of gasification. I'm here with Richard, who's going to explain what gasification is. Now, Richard, people who have been dabbling with this for a while have just been extolling its praises. It's a great way to get energy out of things that we wouldn't normally get energy from. What is gasification?
Absolutely. It is it's an old technology. Basically, we're superheating a hydrocarbon, and we're processing the smoke into a clean gas, a combustible gas that will run a standard engine with a generator connected to it. So today, we are running a 20-kilowatt generator on walnut shells.
This is one of these technologies that has been around for a very, very long time, but it fell out of favor because, well, gasification has always been very inconvenient. You need a lot of material that can provide hydrocarbons. You need heat to be able to heat those hydrocarbons out of the material, and then you need some way to filter it into an engine. What have you done here to turn it into an all-in-one solution?
This is an integrated machine that processes the hydrocarbon through the gasification process, filtering it, cleaning it, and providing a clean fuel source for the internal combustion engine. This is marketing for places where they're paying an extortive amount of money for diesel. We're replacing diesel generators in the deep developing worlds of where they have a lot of biomass that's available and no diesel.
Well, you know, that's just too bad that, yeah, we are kind of spoiled. We like our really cheap oil. We like our really cheap energy. And we take technologies like this and we just turn away from it. Now, if they wanted to find out more about gasification, about what you do for developing countries, where can they go?
Allpowerlabs.com.
I'm Father Robert Ballas there, and the future might be gas.
From walnut shells.
From walnut shells.
I have a little confession to make. The very first time I saw a gasifier was in this reality show called The Colony, where, you know, it was one of those silly things where they dropped them into a deserted part of Los Angeles, and they said, okay, you have to make a life now. And one of the things that they built was a gasifier, because they had a lot of scrap wood, and they needed to run a generator to generate power. And so they basically took a 50-gallon drum, chopped the top off of it, put another 50-gallon drum, and then heated up a bunch of wood chips. Now, that actually is also known as a bomb, so be very careful when you're experimenting with this. But it's technology that does actually work. I mean, if we ever got to that point where we needed to turn one form of fuel into something that would run a different type of device, gasification would actually work.
Mm-hmm. That is the big problem with a lot of alternative fuels. They also explode.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, energy. It's just about energy. Anything mm-hmm. with a lot of energy, there's a chance at some point to release that energy in an uncontrolled way, and bad things happen.
That's what I want to happen to me at Maker Faire.
You want to explode.
And, yeah, only good things to
okay,
happen. Release all the energy.
Now, a few of the other things you actually saw there, that music, the klezmer music, which, by the way, that band is awesome. I've seen them two or three times since then. All the amplification was done, it was powered by bikes. So they had audience members who had to get on, and they had to power the bikes in order for everyone else to hear the music. So, I mean, that's the kind of hippie spirit that you get at Maker Faire. I kind of like it. It's weird. You sit it down on the grass, you watch a bunch of people spin around, and you go, oh, all right, I'm home.
Awesome.
Yeah. All right, let's go to something a little bit more practical. Gasification is fun if you're planning for that post-apocalyptic future, but there is another side of Maker Faire, and that's the companies that start there. They want to show off something that they developed they think other people might be interested in, and it really gives them an opportunity to get a huge focus group to say, is this product actually going to work? This is one of the companies that showed something off, and it actually did make it to market. And, believe it or not, it's for the outdoorsman. This is a kayak that you can fold up into a handbag.
Thank you.
Father Robert Ballister here at Maker Faire 2015, where Maker meets the great outdoors. I'm standing next to Alex, who's going to explain what Oru Kayak is doing for people who want to get out. What is this?
It's a foldable kayak. It's the original origami kayak, actually. You can fold it up to a small box right there, as you can see. You can pack it up and just hike with it, really. Put it in the back of your car. Put it in the closet. It's just very portable, very easy to travel with. It's a great option for people that have a small space to store their gear and just want to get outside.
I actually do live with someone who does kayaking all the time. He has three kayaks. They're huge. They're unwieldy. He has to keep them on top of his truck or on a loading rack. The idea that I could fold this up into what is essentially check-in baggage, that's completely different. Now, the material that you chose for this, it feels like heavy-duty corrugated plastic. What is this?
That's exactly what it is. It's corrugated plastic. It's the same material they use for U.S. postal boxes, but we have it extruded especially for us. It's thicker, stronger. Super lightweight. It's perfect for boats, really. And yeah, as you said, boats are usually very, very heavy. This is super lightweight. It's amazing.
There are going to be those people, especially kayak aficionados, who are going to say, I'm not going to trust my life to something that is used in postal box office containers. What have you done to this to make sure that you actually maintain rigidity and the stability while you're actually using it?
Well, we also put in some bulkheads on each end of the kayak. So really, it's very rigid boat. It's we've done extensive testing on it. It's super safe. It's very stable. It's a great boat. It's super fun. Since it's so lightweight also, it's very easy to maneuver. It's a great fun.
Where can they go if they want to find out more information?
They can go to www.orukayak.com. Check our website. We have a ton of videos. We're launching a new one in a couple of days on Kickstarter. Back us up. Check us out.
I'm Father Robert Ballister, and that's been your first look.
That's amazing.
It is kind of cool. And it's a little bit pricey if you've never done kayaking before, because they start at $1,300 and they go up based on how well equipped you want the thing. But if you price out like a traditional kayak, it's going to be more expensive than that. Mm-hmm. Those things are actually a little bit pricey because they're more or less handmade one-off type devices. Mm-hmm. The nice thing about this is, again, if you've ever seen someone with a kayak, I lived with a Jesuit who had a bunch of them, you have to have special equipment to get them to and from. Mm-hmm. This is literally put it in the back of the car and drive and then open it up and go.
We had two kayaks that we got at Costco, and they were when the kids were a little bit littler. And they were hard. They were so hard to get places. We never even really used them that much.
Yeah, because I mean, they're unwieldy, and you kind of need two people, but it's a one-person kayak. So, I mean, again, what I like about this, it was a concept that started at Maker Faire, and they had no idea if there would be a market for this. They had enough people come by and say, okay, I'd buy one of those, that they actually launch it. And, Burke, if you go to the link for that now, this is actually something you can buy. So this is no longer a Maker Faire thing. This is no longer a Kickstarter thing. This is an actual company that will sell you a device that has all the warranties and guarantees that you would expect from a company-offered product. So Oru Kayak, you know, good job on you, because a lot of times that doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. A lot of times these just kind of fall through. All right, let's go ahead and continue our perusal through the world of Maker Faire. Now, Megan, I know that you have been getting into IoT, the Internet of Things. It's kind of, I mean, because honestly, a lot of the devices that we play with these days are sold as IoT.
Yes, it's true. I mostly in my house, but I'm, you know, also in the car and other places and looking into commercial IoT as well. It's an interesting space because it really has to solve, whatever your device is, has to solve a problem that's really big and bigger than the problems it might create. And so it's a really interesting space.
Yeah, I thought we would take a look at one of those areas in the makerspace. Now, typically when people think of IoT, they think of Arduino or they think of Raspberry Pi. Those are the two biggest options, but that's not the only option. There's actually a group out there making a fantastic set of tools, hardware, and programming assists that I think typify what a Maker Faire is all about. So let's go ahead and take a trip with the BeagleBone.
Space for a while, you've probably heard the name BeagleBoard. But exactly what what is the Beagle Board and the Beagle Bone? That's why I'm speaking with Jason, who's going to explain why this technology is your next embedded project. Jason, what is Beagle Board and what is the Beagle Bone?
So the organization that put these boards together is the BeagleBoard.org Foundation. And so it's a nonprofit that works on moving forward Linux and open hardware. And the Beagle Bone is the product. We first launched the original Beagle Bone in 2011, followed by the very successful Beagle Bone Black in 2013. And this year we're launching the Beagle Bone Black Wireless. And that's what I'm holding in my hands. This is the new cool stuff. And it's what gives everybody an opportunity to prototype their own concepts with Linux and open hardware.
Well, we've seen a lot of these communities create their own organization. Raspberry Pi has an organization. Arduino has an organization. And I've always seen the BeagleBone as it's the higher end. It's the higher level of embedded processor. I saw them all the time at DEF CON, all the time at Black Hat. What is it that you think differentiates the philosophy of your organization from some of the others?
Open source hardware is really absolutely critical to who we are. We also work with, instead of using like media chips or stuff for tablets, we work with devices that are intended for industrial controllers. I call it kindergarten to Kickstarter, right? I mean, our goal is to make it really, really easy to enter. So you plug it in, there's a web server that's already running on the board, we have built-in flash, it's all programmed and ready to go. You don't need to go buy SD cards, you don't need to go buy USB cables, it's already there. And then kindergarten to Kickstarter, right? Because we don't get in your way when you want to actually make a product, right? You can get all the chips. You can get the there's no NDAs required to go and get all the data sheets, everything you need, and release all our designs in the open. We're continuing to make that easier. So with the BeagleBone Black Wireless, we've now used a SIP that you can go and buy yourself that integrates 145 components into a single chip, making it as easy to develop a Linux system as you would a microcontroller system. And, you know, we've all designed the board in CatSoft Eagle. For a lot of the hobbyists, will be very familiar. It's a very affordable package to get started developing PCBs with. And we release all our designs in the open. So easy for people to get going and no barriers for when they want to move forward.
Well, let's talk about these features. Because, of course, the BeagleBone, especially the BeagleBone Black, is a full-featured development board.
Absolutely.
What kind of features will people be able to play with? I know that you're adding wireless now, but, you know, how much memory will they get to play with? What is it that you think really sets your product aside from, you know, the clone Arduino Nano that someone might buy on eBay from China?
Yeah, so most of the, like something like an Arduino Nano is a microcontroller. It's not a Linux system. So we're a gigahertz processor, you know, running Linux with 512 megabytes of RAM, right? Essentially, with the SIP, you apply 5 volts, you give it a boot source, and you have a Linux computer on a chip, right? And then around that CPU, it's not just the processor. There's two 32-bit 200 megahertz microcontrollers. They're 32-bit just available for doing I.O. So those are a lot faster than any of your little microcontroller boards to begin with. And they're just free, sitting there extra around the gigahertz processor. So you can start doing all your real-time interfacing stuff. So it allows us to build things like these mobile robots where we have quadrature encoder hardware and software where we can actually give feedback on where the wheels are positioned, right? We have 8 hardware pulse width modulators. We can provide the drive strength, right, to tell where the wheels are going to go. I mean, we can get pretty into acronym bills, but it's just so many more peripherals because we're built around an industrial control part. There's so many different I/O things that don't even have to be handled by the main processor or the microcontrollers, right? There's already something in there to handle it specifically in hardware.
Jason, that's absolutely fantastic. Thank you so very much for talking to us and letting us know a little bit about what the BeagleBone actually is. If they wanted to find out more about the BeagleBone Black, more about the new developments, more about the BeagleBoard organization, where should they go?
Absolutely, you should visit BeagleBoard.org. It's just that simple.
Folks, if you are looking for a bit more out of your embedded processor, a bit more out of your next project, maybe you got to get bad to the BeagleBone.
I don't know if he appreciated your pun.
You know, I put time and effort into those.
Okay.
Actually, I don't. Yeah, see, that's the face of. Oh gosh, who am I talking to again? That was horrible. Now the fun thing about the whole BeagleBoard line of devices and tools is they're a bit more security conscious than you would get with a Raspberry Pi or with an Arduino, and that's starting to become a thing. Because mm-hmm. I mean, how many jokes have you heard over the last couple of years? The internet of owned things or the internet of hacked things. It's kind of synonymous with insecure. So it's nice to have a foundation that says, no, it doesn't have to be that way. Mm-hmm. We can keep you from making some of the most basic security mistakes when you decide to put X device onto the internet. Mm-hmm. That's kind of important these days.
Sorry, I had to sneeze.
No, it's an allergy thing. Both of us are getting blasted by pollen here in California.
I mean,
it's so like this morning, driving to the studio, it was beautiful in San Francisco, so I rolled down my windows and I immediately regretted it as I started watering because it's in the air now.
Yeah, we need an IoT pollen killer.
Now that you say that, okay, I'll work on it. Now, let's go ahead and move on to something else. Now, you've seen me play with 3D printers. In fact, we were going to do a 3D printing project in the, you know, a very soon episode. Unfortunately, I kind of broke my 3D printer. However, something that I have been eyeing with jealously, envy even, has been 3D printers that can do electronics. Because it's one thing to be able to print the shell of my next project. It's an entirely other thing to have a printer that will print out a circuit board, a custom circuit board, so that I don't have to shoehorn other components into my build. I can actually have the components be part of the build. The problem has been that those tend to be ridiculously expensive. There was one model that was selling for like $15,000.
Oh, well.
That's not Padre money. That's more Megan Maroney money.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But 15 of those kayaks.
I know, 50. Oh, exactly. Exactly. And actually, in our chat room right now, we've sparked up quite an interest in kayaks. So, I mean, I think our audience, our kiddos, are much more outdoorsmen and women. Is that outdoors woman?
You could say outdoors people.
Outdoors people.
You're covered.
than I thought. But let's get back into the lab and take a look at the Volterra. Don't you wish it was as easy to print a circuit board as it is to print a 3D object? Well, with Volterra, it is. I'm speaking with Al Roy, who's going to explain what the V1 can do for your makerspace. Al Roy, what's the idea behind the V1?
Well, you know, it all started when we got really excited about 3D printers, but we're all electrical guys, and we said, where's our rapid prototyping tool? How do we get, you know, circuit boards, you know, right away instead of sending them out to a factory and waiting for weeks for them to arrive? So that's what led us down the path to creating the Volterra V1. And so right now we've built this amazing printer that can print circuit boards right from your desktop in an hour rather than sending them out.
What I love about this is some of these are, if you're a maker, these are readily recognizable. If you look at this board, you think, oh yeah, that's an Arduino Nano. I've seen those. I bought a bunch of those from eBay, clones from China. But now I can actually make it inside the comfort of my own lab. I can order the components. I can assemble it exactly the way it needs to be without having to wait for lead times of these prototyping shots. Tell me, what's the process? What do I need to make this work? How do I design my boards? What kind of consumables am I going to be looking at?
Yeah. So you can design your circuits in whatever CAD tool you're already comfortable with. We take Gerber files as the input. So you just drag and drop them into our software and go through a little quick calibration step and then print. And the ink that we use is a silver nanoparticle-based conductive ink. And so we lay that down based on what your Gerber files dictate. There's a short curing cycle. After that, you swap off the conductive ink, throw on solder paste. We've got a cartridge for that as well. It'll dispense paste on all the pads. And we also have a 500-watt heater that'll reflow your entire board for you. And we can do that on boards that you printed on the V1 or boards that you got fabbed at a factory. Either way, we're just trying to help get rid of stencils, get rid of breadboards, get people building actual electronics quicker, faster, and better than ever before.
So this really is a one-stop shop. I can draw my board, I can put down the paste, I can place the components and reflow it all within the V1.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, now guide me through the cartridge thing. So you've got several cartridges. This is magnetically held inside of it.
Yeah.
How do I swap it out? What do I need to do during the process?
Yep. So I can lean over here and show you. We wanted to make the printer itself as stupidly simple to use as possible. It literally got one power button on the front and then these magnetically swappable print heads. So we have one for the conductive ink, one for the solder paste, and it's as simple as that. Everything else is pushed into our software package, where even there, the same sort of design principles are reflected, where we're trying to make it as intuitive to use the tool and the software as possible, so people are focusing on designing great stuff, not on learning how to level a bed or do all these different things. So in our software, we literally have videos playing alongside saying, now do this, now take this cartridge off, now clamp your board down, because it just makes getting up and running, you know, a breeze.
Let's talk about that learning curve a little bit, because one of the things that really sped up the development of 3D printing was things like Thingiverse and all these sites where you could share designs with other people who could take your design, maybe tweak it a little bit, and make it their own. Are you thinking about creating something like that for the Volterra community, where designs that people are proud of can be shared? People can take, say, oh, my custom Arduino board, my custom Atmel board, and then make a couple of changes and make it for their application.
You know, that's already starting to happen on our forums right now. We've got all the people that currently have a V1 are out there printing stuff, sharing designs, and getting other people to build them too. And some pretty cool stuff is coming out of it. We just had somebody print a 915 megahertz antenna and was doing some like wireless stuff. So it's, you know, honestly, that's what we get up for in the morning, is to check the forums and see what people are doing, what they're building. And it's amazing to see this community start to grow over the last few months. It's insane.
All right, the big question is going to be pricing and availability. If they're enticed by what they've seen, if they think that maybe they want one of these in their maker shop so they can fast prototype all their boards, where do they go? How much is it going to cost?
So www.volterra.io, VOLTERA.io. We're already done fulfilling our Kickstarter. We are shipping as orders come in now. And so the printer itself is $21.99. That comes with the printer, the conductive ink, the solder paste, all the boards and accessories you need to get started. Get them while they're still there.
Roy, thank you so very much. And thank you for making something that I think it's got a niche in the maker community that I think needed to be filled. Folks, here at Volterra, you can dream it, you can design it, you can build it, and then just print it.
Now, I will say I was kind of salivating over this thing when I first saw it at World Maker Faire, and I thought, $21.99, that's reasonable. I wonder if it'll drop. And I thought, if it gets down to like the $1,500 mark, then maybe, okay, that might be something for me. However, Burke, if you go to that link there, it's actually gone in the opposite direction. Once they started scaling up and they realized there was a demand for this, they're now selling for upwards of, you know, 34 all the way up to 4,000.
That's a lot.
Depending on how you wanted it equipped. So, yeah. I wish I had gotten in on that early.
Yeah.
Now, okay, it's not just super geeky things, though, because that's what we've shown you the last two segments. You saw a little bit about the BeagleBoard, Association. You saw about the Volterra. That's for hardcore makers who have a, you know, seriously focused use for the tools that they're going to buy. I also wanted to show you the other side of Maker. And this is not just the musical side, the Burning Man side. This is what I really like about it. And that's the amateurs who show up. And they just want to show people something that they made. Mm. I mean, I know that your boys, they're getting into science fairs mm-hmm. now. In fact, was it Huck?
Huck, yeah. His team won the robotics competition.
Congratulations, mm-hmm. Huck. Mm-hmm. And who did the project with Dixie Cups?
That's also Huck.
That's also
yes.
So Huck's got. Yeah, you know what? Maybe you need to drag Huck to this thing.
I think I might. Maybe, but both boys would like to.
That would be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they just show something that they've created. They have no idea about turning it into a business. There's no business model here. It's just sort of, I made this and I'm proud of it. I'd like you to see it. This is a group that I found. It must have been three years ago at the Maker Faire here in San Mateo. They were just local high school students who, at the start of the drone craze, decided, we want to build something a little bit different. So what they made was an aircraft that could do vertical takeoff and landing.
That is really scary, Padre.
Father Robert Ballaser, the digital Jesuit at Maker Faire 2015 for Twit TV. Now, we have seen some interesting concoctions and gadgets here at the fair, but one of the ones that seems to tickle my heart the most is this. This is a VTOL craft. It allows you to take off as a quadcopter and transition to a traditional flight. I'm standing next to Dylan, who's going to explain how this works. How did you decide to create something like this?
So we're using an open source firmware here. It's called OpenAero VTOL. This frame is completely, well, the foam frame here we got off Hobby King, and then everything else was custom built. So we were very inspired by, like, the future of aerospace. We really thought this was going to be the future. And because it can do vertical takeoff and landing, once the rotors are tilted horizontally, we also think that it has the capability to do to be submersible. So that's really interesting for us.
Come a little closer. First of all, they're using 40-amp electronic speed controllers. That gives you a little taste of how much power they're driving to their motors. But if you look here, this flight controller is just a KK. It's a KK2. This is the same flight controller that we've been recommending for all our beginning builds. Now, I got to ask, that's obviously not built into the KK. There is no VTOL flight selection. So how did you make the KK handle this?
It's an open source firmware. You just have to flash the KK with the open source code that's on the internet. So it has a gyroscope, auto leveling capabilities. So it's really very cool. So once it tilts, it actually has a capability to put some more thrust on the back rotor, so it won't fall. So I think that's really interesting.
Let's take a look at the actual operation. So this one is straightforward, right? You've got a forward operation, you've got a backward operation. When it's straight up, you're operating as a quadcopter. When it tilts forward, it's providing the forward thrust. But then how does the back work? Because obviously you don't want it pulling the back down.
Yep. So the back, the motors in the back, they're spinning counterclockwise, right? So all these propellers are clockwise rotation. And then, so that one actually prepares these motors back here, actually propel the quadcopter up because the motors are rotating the other way.
If they want to find out more about your project, if they want to find out more about how you did this, where can they go on the internet to find out?
So we don't actually have any videos yet, but there are many awesome videos about VTOLs online. You can check out Happy Sundays or there are many... Yeah, just search up anything on YouTube, basically.
Thank you very much for talking to us, and thank you for sharing this with us. I'm hoping that more and more makers will make stuff that just blows away the old genres. I'm Father Robert Ballasaire here at Maker Faire 2015.
That's amazing.
The fun thing about that was after that, there were groups of students who actually tried to imitate them. And there was one video on YouTube. It looked almost exactly the same setup. A little bit more expensive. They used carbon fiber rods. And it was fine until it ripped itself apart during flight. So, I mean, it's not as simple as it looks. Mm-hmm. It's the classic challenge of an airframe, which is you need to make it sturdy, but it can't be too heavy. And if it's multi-purpose, now you have one airframe that's withstanding stresses from multiple directions. That's really hard to design. So kudos to high school kids who designed to tackle that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, let's go ahead and take a little trip into something a bit that you're going to see at the beginning of the show. Because okay. Every time you come through, there's always two or three vendors right at the front of San Mateo Maker Faire that are showing off their CNC machines. So we've seen what 3D printers can do. 3D printers will add material, be it plastic or electronics, to slowly build up what it is that you want to create. There's a whole other genre of tools that are sort of like the shop bot, shop vac, CNC type machines, where you start with material and then you have a robot take that away. It's subtractive printing. Same idea, you know, you have a head moving around a tool, but in one case you're adding material, in one case you're subtracting material.
Why would you need to subtract material?
Well, sometimes you have a solid block of aluminum and you want to make a part, or a solid block of wood and you want to make a design.
Got it.
It's one's not better than the other. You could argue that in certain cases one might be stronger than the other, but it's good to know them both, because the more tools you have, mm-hmm. the more ways you have to build whatever it is that you're building. So let's go ahead and take a look at a shop bot.
So if you're a maker, you've probably used your Dremel tools. This is the VRT1. It's a vacuum rotary tool. The idea is if you have a shop vac, like the one I have down here, you can use that to both power the tool and to keep your workspace free of debris. If you've ever used one of these tools, you know it can get a little bit messy. quite simply, turn on your vacuum, engage the tool, and now not only can I use all of my attachments, but you'll see it vacuums up the debris from the workspace. This is actually a really good idea. If you have a makerspace in an area that you share with other people or that you really don't want to get messy, the VRT1 is for you. Makers are all about 3D printers, but if you want precision, if you want strength, nothing quite beats CNC, which is why I'm speaking with Ted Hall from ShopBot, who's going to explain how you can get precision out of one of their handybots. Ted, thank you very much for speaking with us. Now, what am I looking at?
Well, you're looking at a very small CNC tool. We think of it as a smart power tool. It's got intelligence and something that you can pick up, put down on a table, put down on your work material, put down on a board, or in this case, we put it on top of an accessory that has an additional turning option underneath. I couldn't have said it better myself about 3D printing is great, but sometimes you need to make stuff with real materials that can scale as well. And we think this little tool that combines a lot of precision and power is one way to get at that.
Can you guide me through what kind of materials I can print with? I see we've got wood here, we've got acrylic, we've even got aluminum. What kind of experience do I need in order to be able to properly machine these materials?
Well, you're right. One of the advantages of the subtractive technique is that you usually have a wider range of materials available to you. And with HandyBots, wood, foam, plastics, acrylics of one sort or another, soft metals like aluminum and brass are all, copper are all machinable. You can make printed circuit boards, that kind of thing. The skill level is a step higher than people often conceptualize 3D printing. There's a little bit more than click to print. But increasingly, the tools from getting from a CAD drawing or a model of what you want to make to the actual part are getting better and a lot easier to do. And so we're thinking, yeah, it's one step harder than 3D printing, but it's well within the grasp of anybody who's at all comfortable with drawing or creating in CAD gives you.
All right, big question. Our audience is going to want to know, if they wanted to start in CNC and perhaps start with one of your smaller units, what is it going to run them? And then how far can they go if they wanted to start building larger objects?
Well, these tools cost $2,800, $2,795. We've been selling them for several years, and we think that's a great way to get into CNC just because of the range of materials and kind of work that a HandyBot will do. And you can do much bigger pieces by taking the tool and tiling across a larger area. But at some point, that gets inefficient. And if you're really looking towards cutting large sheets of plywood or something like that, you want a CNC tool that's got a larger format to it.
Ted Hall, thank you very much for speaking with us. Now, if they wanted to find out more about the HandyBot, where they might be able to pick one up, or maybe where they can get something fabbed by one of your partners, where can they go?
Well, you can find out all about HandyBots on the HandyBot website if you don't make it to Maker Faire here this weekend. So it's HandyBot.com, and there's all sorts of samples and videos of the tool in action. ShopBot sponsors a larger network of digital fabbers that include people with CNC tools, 3D printers, laser cutters, and the network is called 100kgarages.com, 100,000garages.com. You can go to that on the website and find somebody in your neighborhood who will help you make something with digital fab, will teach you how to use it and help get you involved, or just make your parts for you.
Again, Ted Hall, thank you very much. If you're a maker, give yourself a hand, D-Bot.
It's gold, Megan. It's gold.
You don't even see that.
I get the idea now. It's like you're like a little Rodin with your sculpture tool.
Exactly.
It's a robot.
The more expensive tools, they have more degrees of freedom, so they can actually come in from the side, not just from the top. And some of the newest devices, and I'm hoping there'll be a few of these at Maker, can both add and subtract, which is amazing. It's, you know, one box that will build, that can start with material, maybe start milling it away, machining it away, and then also can do additive printing, which that's kind of the dream, because that means that you can basically make anything. You could put in support items so that you can print properly, and then take them away when everything is done. So hopefully we'll see that at some point in the near future. I definitely wouldn't mind reviewing one or two of them.
Mm-hmm. We need a 3D printer that can make humans. I know you can make human
okay.
parts.
We're working on that. I'm not even joking. We as the human race, are experimenting with cellular 3D printers, mm-hmm. which can deposit individual cells in a matrix. Now, it is still a long way from that to living tissue that can be implanted in a human, but, I mean, we've at least shown the concept is viable.
Mm-hmm.
It's exciting.
I mean, they can 3D print tracheas and, like, different kind of body parts
right.
and stuff, for sure. But I just want a whole human baby printed from...
You know, Patrick just, his wife just 3D printed a baby.
Yeah.
That worked pretty well, I think.
I don't know how it got there.
Wait, what?
So what you're saying is that I'm not going to see human-printed people at Maker Faire.
You might. I mean, unless you go to every person and ask them, were you 3D printed, how are you going to know?
I might try that.
This could be a very interesting Maker Faire. This week on Know How, Padre and Megan get kicked out of Maker Faire. All right, one last one. And this one is actually, I really, really enjoyed it. It's not super techie. There's no tools in this. There's nothing that they really built with microcontrollers, but it's more of a philosophy. Now, Megan, I know that you and Jason actually just got your own homes here in Petaluma,
mm-hmm.
And ownership is fun, right? It's mm-hmm. it's nice to have a house. It's nice to have a place that you can call your own, but there's sort of a movement, and I will actually say Petaluma is one of the areas where it's really kind of focused in the Bay Area. Have you ever heard of the tiny home or the tiny house movement?
I have heard of the tiny, and I'm very interested in it. With a family of five, it's not as practical
yeah.
as I would like it to. But, you know, I mean, they won't live with me forever, I hope, so.
We'll see.
I hope my husband does, but the kids, hopefully they will move out.
I mean, you talk about disruptive. Most of us think a measure of success is you buy yourself a big house, right? So even if it's just you, you have, what, a 4,000, 5,000, 10,000 square foot home where you put all your stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to get a job to afford the stuff you put in your home as mm-hmm. well as the home, which means then you can buy a bigger house. So.
It's
a vicious cycle. It's a vicious cycle. The tiny home / tiny house community is kind of focused on these 100 square foot homes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of a magic number here, at least in California, because 100 square foot means you don't need a permit for it. It's mm-hmm. it's a shed. It's not a home. The question is, how much can you actually fit into 100 square feet? And what happens when you start building a community around these tiny homes? What do you have? Tiny parks? Do you have, you know, tiny convenience stores? Well, there was one professor at Maker Faire in New York who had an idea for a tiny park.
Maker Faire is the intersection between technology and so many different disciplines. In this particular case, it's nature. I'm speaking with Kim, who designed this parklet, trailer, nature thing. What exactly do you call this?
It's everything from a mobile trailer, trailer park, mobile parklet, park trailer, parking day. We've got everything. We've got the tiny house movement takes a little piece of this, you know. So we've got an aquaponic pond. I love permaculture. I've got a micro veggie patch. So there's a little bit of everything going on in this mobile parklet. So a little bit of everything.
I'm so happy that you mentioned the tiny house movement, because I have just been, yep. I've been taken by that. I love that idea of, well, can you simplify your life? Can you get it down into a small space? Can you get rid of everything you don't need? And this is a great concept, something that you can roll up into a parking, literally yeah. into a parking space in the middle of a crowded city like San Francisco or New York, and have a little bit of peace, a little bit of green. What went into creating this space?
So this is actually the second version of a trailer park that I've made, and this is a more compact version, like you said, inspired by the tiny house movement. So what I did was I actually built retaining planter beds that hug the perimeter of the space. We've got bench seating in the middle. And actually, the way that this is weighted and how this is all designed, it's extremely agile and portable. So it just takes two people to lift it up and move it around. And you can actually turn it into a 360-degree circle and put it wherever you need it to be, just with human power. So that's a definite advantage. And as you can see, I'm able to jam-pack a lot of different living species and living environments and different types of living planted material in here. Like I mentioned, the aquaponics, but then I also have a more traditional veggie patch. But this one is a mini veggie patch, so it's only mini vegetables that I'm going to be growing in here to sort of represent the theme. So,
and of course, this is not designed to be a sustainable food source. It's designed to be a quiet space that just happens to have a lot of nature. But I could see something like this, because we've done shows on our network. We have a DIY show. We did a series called Grow How, right, which was, you know, showing people how the basics of planting. And we're starting to get into aquaponics. Exactly. This is the kind of thing where I could see that project heading to. Where do you want to take this next? So this is your second version. What does the third version have in store?
I think the third version might actually start to allow some technology to incorporate, because as technology is growing, it's recognizing the permaculture movement. It's recognizing that urban organic, urban farming initiative. And so now what you have are a lot of technologies that are about plant care, recognizing things like humidity, soil, nutrients, how the plants are doing, if they're happy or not, based upon a lot of different aggregated data. So you can even essentially, what I would like to do next is get, you can get a portable AccuWeather station, attach it to the top of the trailer, and then you actually have real data that you're gathering about the weather outside of the trailer park and the conditions of the air and the moisture and the atmosphere, as opposed to what you're actually experiencing inside the trailer, and really looking at the differences created between a sort of a saturated, natural, oxygenated environment, where you're the human surrounded by the nature, as opposed to being outside where there is nature, but you're not necessarily able to have that intimate, one-on-one, direct nature experience where you're really getting the oxygen, you're putting your hands in the soil, you're getting the nutrients, you're getting that sort of like micro living experience where you see the small insects and you see the little shoots of all of the growing little sprouts coming out and little surprises everywhere inside of these beds that grow wild, essentially. So,
well, thank you for this. Thank you for this creation. This is definitely the spirit of Maker. If they wanted to find out more about your project, more about where you might be heading, more about you, where can our audience go?
Well, my name is Kim Holloman. I'm one lone artist, and I do a lot of different things, but you can look up anything that I'm doing on my website at kimholloman.com.
Kim, an absolute pleasure and an honor. Thank you again for sharing your vision. And folks, the future is not a trailer park. It's a park in a trailer.
Come on, give me that one. No?
Oh, okay. That one was the best of the horrible.
Of the awful. The best. Okay.
Pun.
You know what? I'll take it.
Okay.
I'll take it. But here's the people will look at this and they'll scoff at it because they'll say, well, you don't actually own the land, which is true, but that's true of a condo as mm-hmm. well. They'll say, well, just move someplace else. And sure, fine. It'd be great if you could always move to a more affordable part of the country, but sometimes you can't.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than just that. This is not just, oh, it's a cheap place to live. It's a different way of living. And I'd love to get your thoughts on this. Granted, you have a family, but do you think it would be possible for you to pare down what you have so that you could actually live in a 100-square-foot house?
I would hope so. I mean, I definitely think that we don't live in a giant house for five people,
right,
and
right.
We've lived in much smaller houses. And I think paring down is important, just getting rid of stuff, as long as you're getting rid of it responsibly. I do feel strongly about that, just that idea of just accumulating
yeah.
stuff being like a sign of, you know, happiness. Yeah, if I just keep getting more stuff, I'll be
all
happy.
All my stuff.
Yeah. But I also love the plant idea of it. I have a black thumb. Like, I kill everything.
I did, too. And then we did Grow How, and I kind of got
learned?
Better.
I don't know. You're yeah. amazing with it. I mean, my grandfather was a gardener like that, and my great-grandfather was a gardener. Like, that mm-hmm. was their job.
That was their thing.
And
yeah.
That was how they made a living. And some of that has, like, trickled down genetically to parts of my family, but it did not make it to me. But I was visiting my cousin in Brooklyn. She has a tiny little apartment in Brooklyn, and it's covered in plants. And she just, you know, she knows about them. She calls herself a crazy plant lady. Like, you know, there were three of us in this tiny apartment when we went, my sister and my daughter and I, and like the plants could tell, like they needed more water because they were like humans sucking up the oxygen. And it was something I hadn't even really thought about because I'm just so bad at, you know, understanding plant life. I can raise human children or possibly 3D printed children if that's our future. I can do that. But the plants, I wish I were better at it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when you think about it, I actually live in a tiny home. because I move from community to community. My room is about 100 square feet, and all my stuff has to fit into it. Now, I there's an exception made for me because I have a studio, and I've got all the stuff that goes into a studio, but people in my profession, typically, we don't accumulate a lot because we're always moving around. And it's not just a different way of holding your stuff or prioritizing your stuff. It's a different way of looking at what you value. We have people in the chat room who are saying, but could you live for the rest of your life in a 100 square foot home? Well, no, that's the point. If you're not having to pay for the mortgage for a huge home and all the stuff that you put into that home, do you have to work 12 months out of the year?
Mm-hmm.
We have people in San Francisco living next to us, next to our campus right now. They basically just park their tiny homes in little areas like the backyards of houses that are already there. And they work maybe 3 months out of the year, and then they travel for 9 months. And that's not vacation. That's the way they live.
Mm-hmm.
They say, look, we live in the tiny home, and we have to be there, and we have to do the work because we need to make a living. But because we don't have to pay this huge monthly tab, our 3 months of income lasts us more than the 9 months for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually very attractive to a lot of people.
Yeah, and as we're as technology is making more robots,
right.
And we're gonna have to figure out a different way to work because it's not. I hope that we're not just continuing on this, like we work 8 hours to be able to buy more stuff to, you know, store it in storage areas. And, you know, I think that we're going to see an evolution of work. I don't know if it's going to be in our lifetime. That'll depend on the 3D printed babies.
And we have both had guests on Triangulation who are kind of pointing us to that. They're saying the way that we're living right now, it's not sustainable. We know it's going to change. Everyone knows it's going to change. Just no one wants to be the generation that has to go through the pain mm-hmm. of making that change. Well, the maker movement is partially about that. It's about getting us to understand things do change, and sometimes these completely out of right field, wacky ideas become the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I wanted you to see. With all of these, this is the sort of cornucopia that you're going to be getting with Maker. So when you walk into that fair, you're going to be a little bit overwhelmed. You're probably going to be a little bit scared by some of the crazy people, but the crazy people are part of it, and I want you to enjoy that.
Okay. Do I have to dress a certain way?
You know what? You dress the way you want to dress.
Okay.
I will be dressing kind of crazy.
Okay.
That's a thing.
But you will be wearing clothes.
We'll see you next week for our coverage. Actually, no, it's not next week. Next week, I'm going to have Jason Howe. We're going to be doing another Synology NAS module. But the week after, Megan and I will have returned from Maker Faire. And if there's any fun stuff, we'll be bringing it back for you. Does that sound like a plan?
Sounds like a plan.
Folks, we know that this was a lot of information. We want to make it very easy for you to get both this episode and all the episodes we've got in our know-how catalog. Almost 400 episodes, which is ridiculous mm-hmm. when you think about it. Now, Megan, where do they go for our show notes?
They go to twit.tv/KH.
That's right. There you'll find... I'm not sure what that was. But, Burke, bring that back. I mean, I like people with spinning wheels. That's I don't think that's even in our catalog, but okay. Fantastic. But if you go to twit.tv/KH, you're going to find all of our back episodes as well as a place to subscribe. So if you want to get know-how automatically into your device of choice, you can choose an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version. And, just help us out. It's probably the best way to support the show, especially since Jason, Megan, and Leo are going to be taking over in not too long, and you've got some great things planned.
I do, yes. It's you have big shoes to fill, and I have tiny
sandals.
Feet. So,
but I wear socks with my sandals.
Yeah,
so
it's true.
It's all good.
I will never do that. I promise you.
Also, don't forget that the part of the experience is our social media. Please go to Google+. Yes, I know Google+. And find the know-how group, then ask to join. It's just a little process so I can try to keep out the spam accounts. But once you get in, you have access to almost 12,000 Kitas. Those are our know-it-alls, people at every stage of their maker journey. You can ask questions. You can answer questions. You can post pictures and videos of your projects so we can include them here on the show. We also do social media with Twitter. I think mm-hmm. it's a new thing. The crazy kids are doing it. What's yours?
Mine's at Megan Maroney. It's easy.
Yeah, you're mm-hmm. going to find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. And today we have a replacement, Alex, so it's not the Heart of Darkness. Mm-hmm. Burke, do you want to tell people your Twitter address?
I don't do social media.
You're going to find him at twitter.com/ForTheBurke. Just go there and say hi. Until next time, I am Father Robert Ballas here.
I'm Megan Maroney.
And now that you know how, go
make stuff.
Make stuff.
Keep your clothes on.